I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, President Obama gave a speech at Federal Hall on Wall Street, 1 year after the collapse of the investment bank Lehman Brothers. He warned financial executives not to return to their risky and irresponsible behavior, which led to a worldwide crisis. He reminded them the government, meaning taxpayers, had come to their rescue and may not do it again. Obama also called for more stringent regulation of the financial system. According to news accounts, the audience was not enthusiastic about the president's speech. They applauded just once and otherwise looked like they wanted to get the heck out of there. So what have we learned in the last year, and what are the prospects for meaningful oversight and regulation? Put another way, are we headed for another financial meltdown? Let me introduce our guest. Simon Johnson is a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He was the International Monetary Fund's chief economist and director of its research department. He joins us from the studios of Peterson Institute. And Simon Johnson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
So how close were we a year ago to a complete financial meltdown?
Well, we had a complete financial meltdown. The credit markets froze in the week, 10 days after the collapse of Lehman. It was very hard for anyone to borrow on any terms, almost anywhere in the world, actually. That is a financial meltdown. Now, we averted some of the worst consequences of that kind of meltdown, and I think through some heroic actions on the part of the Federal Reserve, a massive, if you like, financial fire was put out and prevented from spreading as widely as it might have to the real economy. There's no question we had a meltdown, and the damage from that was enormous.
We're seeing, though, the stock market beginning to inch its way up. It seems to have stabilized a bit. And some are saying that because we didn't have this sustained total collapse, that means that the system is fixed. What do you say in response to that?
Well, it's obviously not fixed. I don't think anyone really believes that. President Obama certainly didn't say that on Monday. He said that—and actually, his speech was very good at one level. It was very disappointing at another level. But at the level of diagnosis, at the level of saying it is basically a problem of the structure and organization incentives on Wall Street, he absolutely hit the nail on the head. And then he said, you know, it's not fixed yet. And he asked them to please behave nicely going forward, which, of course, they're not going to do if left to their own devices. And he also outlined his own regulatory program. And that's the disappointing part, is that program, those proposals, it's not even clear if they'll become law, but those proposals are anemic and weak at best.
And I do want to get to that. But in terms of the response to the president, are you saying that the president doesn't have the kind of clout to get financial world to behave and stop taking these risks that, of course, risk not just the U.S. economy, but economies around the world?
Well, Marty,
I don't mean to be naive here. I'm trying to put some stuff on the table. But go ahead, Simon Johnson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, and I don't want to sound exaggerated and or outraged or anything, but let me point out that the Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday that not a single chief executive officer, CEO, of any major U.S. bank attended the president's speech on Monday. Okay, so every one of them was too busy to come and hear him speak. That's incredible, right? I mean, that by itself absolutely encapsulates the arrogance of this industry. They're not grateful. They're not sorry. They don't even want to acknowledge that they messed up on a major scale. And the president and the president's men and women saved their rear ends, their companies, their jobs, their salaries, their bonuses, their pensions. Everything was done in amazingly generous terms, I think excessively generous terms. They can't even show up and applaud politely. Extraordinary.
But when the president said, look, if this happens again, we may not come to your rescue, do you think they believed him?
No, of course not. The key word there is we may not, right? So the point is that if you run the Fed and you head the U.S. Treasury and the big financial players as currently constructed come in to see you one Monday, or maybe it's a late on a Sunday afternoon, and they say, oh, you know, if you don't give us the big bailout, we're going to collapse and the world's financial system is going to come down with us. And you look at them in the eye, and maybe they're bluffing, maybe they're not. Maybe they know what will happen, maybe they don't. Well, are you going to risk that? Mm. No, you're not. Right? When you say that these banks are too big to fail, what that means is, in that conversation, and of course it goes to the Oval Office, a decision at that level has to go to the Oval Office, certainly going forward. And the president has to decide, do I take the risk? Do I close down these guys who've clearly messed up, clearly behaved irresponsibly? And do I risk a second Great Depression just to make my point? or do I bail them out? And the big players on Wall Street are very sophisticated, very cynical, very experienced. They know how to play this game. They don't even show up to the guy, to the president's speech, because it's a done deal as far as they're concerned. Next time, there will be another bailout.
But we're talking about, in the last year, mergers. So we're talking about, in some cases, banks that are bigger than ever.
Absolutely. So our biggest banks that were already apparently too big to fail have become bigger because they've acquired other banks and other pieces of the financial industry. The concentration of economic power in the banking sector has gone up. And get this, their political clout on Capitol Hill and more broadly in Washington, where I work part of the week and where I spend a lot of time talking to people and following the nitty-gritty ins and outs of this, the political power of this big finance, I would say, the biggest banks, has actually gone up. The Washington Post has had a series of articles documenting this in a very impressive way, with a lot of detail. And people like Jamie Dimon, for example, who heads J.P. Morgan Chase, says, oh, yeah, now we're focusing much more on our Washington strategy. It's absolutely critical to us as a big bank going forward. These guys know how to play the game, and they pretty much own this town right now.
So if Congress were to, in some ways, create legislation to make banks smaller, you're saying that the chances of that happening are perhaps nil?
It would be very – I mean, first of all, the administration is not proposing that. They've never put that forward. Secondly, it's unlikely that Congress would take up such an idea or that it would get through the legislative process. And thirdly, it's very unlikely that regulators, if they had some discretion in the matter, which they almost certainly would go ahead and enforce that. But that is the key thing. It's the size of your biggest financial players. So CIT Group, which is a substantial financial institution, total assets earlier this year – when they got into serious trouble, about $80 billion, 80. They came for a bailout. They said, if you don't help us out, small and medium-sized business in the U.S. to whom we lend will collapse. And actually, the Treasury, to its credit, and the credit of the rest of the administration, turned them down and said, no, you go sort it out with your creditors, and that's what they've done. And they're going through some sort of, we'd call a bankruptcy process. That was 80. The banks we've had trouble with, the Lehmans, the Bear Stearns, and all these other guys, the Goldman Sachs, are $600 billion, $800 billion, or up to $2 trillion in total assets. Now, if we could take those $2 trillion banks and break them up and turn them more into banks that were below $100 billion in assets, it wouldn't be a panacea, but it would definitely help and move us in the right direction.
You have described the Federal Reserve as the world's greatest bailout machine, and obviously the Federal Reserve can print money and help some of these banks try to stay in business. But you're saying because of the power of the Fed, they have created this moral hazard that encourages bad behavior. Describe for our listeners how that works.
Well, I think to understand the Fed and the Fed, the sort of good side and the bad side of the Fed, you need to go back to the founding of the Federal Reserve, which was after the crisis of 1907. A lot of big, powerful bankers got together and said, we need public money to support the banking system. And Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island was sort of the leader of that faction. But there was also a pushback from the what we now might call the Wilsonian Democrats. And of course, Louis Brandeis was really the person who nailed this one. He had wrote a fantastic series of articles, became a book called Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It. And people like Brandeis said, no, hold on a minute. The bankers are already too powerful. We need to have you can't just give them public money to play with. You have to have sufficient public control over this institution you set up. So the Fed is a compromise, sometimes compromised by this relationship between helping the private bankers, particularly when they get into trouble, particularly when there's a crisis, and having enough public oversight. And in some phases of the Fed history, like in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s, it's actually gone quite well when finance has been very highly regulated. But prior to 1935, it didn't go that well. We had a massive speculative frenzy in the 1920s, a big crash in the Great Depression. And since 1980, we've actually taken away a lot of the regulation that worked after World War II, and we've gone back into this unregulated, deregulated, finance can do whatever it wants, and the Fed will bail you out later. That's the Greenspan philosophy, of course, in a nutshell. That is really, really dangerous. So the Fed is a bailout machine. If you combine it with a tightly regulated financial system, we can all live our lives in pretty well, and we can have plenty of innovation and plenty of growth. That was the post-war experience. If you let finance get out of its box and get deregulated, really bad things happen quite quickly, and they happen again and again and again.
So when the president called for more regulation, what's your critique?
Well, there's nothing wrong with calling for more regulations. What I'm calling for, the question is, what's in the details, right? So if you go through it, point by point and dissect what is the government putting on the table, it's very weak. They're not proposing to break up the biggest banks. There's nothing there about that. They're proposing to increase the amount of capital that the banks have. Capital for banks is the cushion against losses. That's what the shareholders have to lose before everyone turns around, looks at the taxpayer and say, okay, your turn to cough up some money. But the increase of the administration, and the administration, by the way, won't tell you how much they're proposing to increase it. But as far as we can ascertain, those of us who follow this very closely and talk to people on the inside, their increase will be very small. One of my colleagues is actually calling it dinky, as in so small. If it was any smaller, you wouldn't be able to see it.
Right.
If you go back and if you look at how our financial system operated back when it was deregulated, back when there's a lot of risk, it had a total amount of capital, two or three times what we currently allow our banks to have. What our banks have now made sense in the 50s and 60s when they were tightly regulated. It does not make sense anymore. Okay, but the Fed isn't saying that. The president's not saying that. We are not taking on these big issues.
There is a call for something called the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, an agency that would protect consumers as an idea. Do you support that?
Absolutely. That is the one piece of the president's agenda that I think is right. I think it's been well-defined, and I think it's a sensible proposal. It's with Congress now, and of course the banking lobby is vehemently opposed to this. And actually, you can see a lot of the debate by looking at the contrast between how the banks are attacking fully head-on using all kinds of contributions and various other devices that they like to prevent this agency that will protect consumers from coming into being. And on the other hand, all these other regulatory proposals the Obama administration has, the banking industry has no problem with them, has never had a problem with them. They were allowed in on the design inside the administration. They didn't even particularly object to what the administration first put on the table, which tells you that's not pushing these banks at all significantly in the right direction.
There is, and this gets a little bit into the weeds, but it's an important, there are some that are calling for a merger between the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Is that something that, again, where do you stand on that idea?
Well, there's no question that we have too many regulators in the U.S., and a lot of our problems are actually the difference, distinction, and distance between federal regulators and state regulators, for example, around insurance. This is a huge issue. So I'm in favor of consolidating these regulators as much as possible, and what you talked about, this potentially merging the people who regulate securities and the people who regulate
commodities.
Securities,
right.
Different kinds of securities,
exactly.
Of course makes sense. That is incredibly difficult to get through because they report to different committees in Congress. Those committees in Congress do not want to give up that jurisdiction and that authority. So that is an incredible uphill slog. I would like all of the above. That's actually my approach to reform. But you have to make some choices, and I would go much more directly after the underlying structures, the size of the big banks, their capital, and, by the way, the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. It is incredible that you can walk out of a failed Wall Street bank on a Friday and Monday be in charge of the program for bailing out those banks. Okay, that's what when the U.S. sees that in other countries, we're very, very critical of that, and yet that's our current situation.
Well, you know what? Let's take a very short break, and we'll get back to our conversation, and I do want to open up the lines to our listeners. Simon Johnson is our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, also a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and we called him up to join us 1 year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which put the world's economy into a dangerous tailspin. He's joining us to talk about what went wrong and how we can improve our financial system, if at all. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I believe in adaptation.
I believe in a silver lining.
I believe that being flexible keeps me going.
I believe every single person deserves to be acknowledged.
This I believe.
What do you believe in? What are the core values that shape your life? Your family, your neighborhood, your old teacher, or your fondest memories or experiences? Share your beliefs. Visit us at whyy.org/thisibelieve.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY at 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, a look at the fall TV season. Today's forecast, a chance of showers throughout the day into this evening. Today's high 69 degrees. Cloudy overnight, low falling back to 58. Tomorrow, cloudy with a few showers. Thursday's high around 65 degrees. Come Friday, clouds, no rain, perhaps even some breaks of sunshine, high around 72. Sunny on Saturday, high 68 degrees.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Can health clinics in big box stores and elsewhere really replace your primary care physician? Also from town halls and You Lied, Serena Williams and Kanye West, it's getting ugly out there. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen talking with economist Simon Johnson about the lessons learned this year and the prospects for meaningful regulation of the financial sector, of course, 1 year after the collapse of Lehman Brothers this week, this time last year. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Simon Johnson, I heard something recently on NPR. Someone had saved a tape of Bernie Madoff talking to, I think, some potential investors in his company about the SEC and what to do about regulators. He was bragging about how you can hoodwink them and how to essentially sort of trick them into not knowing what it is that's going on in your investment company. Do you think he's unusual? I mean, obviously he sits in prison for this Ponzi scheme, but does he represent an anomaly within the financial system or business as usual?
I think he represents a relatively unsophisticated player, actually. The other big people in finance are much more clever about how they run their schemes. And I guess they do share the ability to outfox the and stay ahead of the SEC. But, of course, there is a question about how hard the SEC has been trying, particularly right. in later years. A lot of the regulators, a lot of people in Washington really believe that what was good for Wall Street was good for the country. And, of course, that turns out to be sadly and almost completely wrong.
Well, because we're learning this week that the median income in this country has dropped about $2,000 from the year 2007 and 2008. The median income for a typical American family is close to $50,000. That's not a lot of money to raise a family on.
Absolutely. Look, median income is not, people with the median income have not done well over the last 20 years, obviously. And inequality has got worse. But, you know, that's not all. I guess it turns out that a lot of what we thought was growth in the early 2000s was not really growth. It was sort of growth at the cost of these massive risks that we'd have to pay for later. And who pays for this? It's people who pay taxes. It's people in the middle of the income distribution a lot. That's where a lot of the income tax burden and the wage tax burden falls. This is a disastrous disastrous outcome for most people in the middle class.
So is Wall Street just entirely disconnected from the rest of the economy?
Yes. I mean, there are some connections. Definitely. I'm not anti-finance. I'm a professor of entrepreneurship, actually.
Yes, I understand
at MIT. And I'm very much in favor of being able to raise capital, take risk, and fund non-financial innovation. And I think venture capital, for example, is absolutely crucial to how, you know, a big part of how this economy moves forward. But the financial sector, as currently constructed and operating in and around Wall Street, has become problematic. I mean, the costs vastly outweigh the benefits from the way they operate. Most of what they call financial innovation is actually extremely, not just not useful to the rest of society, it's extremely dangerous because they're taking on these massive risks, which maybe they understand, maybe they don't, doesn't matter. When it fails, and it does fail, it's designed to fail in an important sense, you know, they come to the taxpayer and ask for money. And it's a form of blackmail, of course, at that stage, because you say, look, you can let us, Jamie Dimon said this, big speech earlier this year, where he said, well, you know, you can let us fail, you can vilify us, you can say it's all our fault, but then you'll have a even bigger recession. You know, it's your choice. What do you want to do? And, of course, that's how they get off the hook.
But are you saying that Wall Street is essentially back to its bad old ways before the bailout and the implosion last fall?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, we're in some ways in worse shape than that. Now, I'm not saying you have another crisis immediately. Right. Back-to-back severe financial crises are very rare. What instead, of course, you go through another cycle where there's, you know, people feel good and their major players can take on a lot of risk. And, of course, they'll have a good run for a while. They'll pay themselves massive bonuses. Mm-hmm. When there's upside, they get the upside. It's the downside that comes 2, 3, 5, maybe 7, 12 years, I don't know, down the road. And that is huge. Look back over the last 20 years. Look, but think about Alan Greenspan's achievement as governor of the central bank, as chairman of the Federal Reserve in this country. In 2001, 2005, all kinds of people said he's the greatest central banker we've ever had. Now you look back and say, I don't think so. I think it was actually a disaster what happened over the past 20 years. He was probably the worst central banker this country's ever experienced.
What do you say about Ben Bernanke so far?
Ben Bernanke has done a very good job as a firefighter. Once the financial fire broke out and once the meltdown occurred, he worked really hard to prevent that from spreading and prevent it from becoming creating even more damage. But, of course, the firefighters have two jobs, generally. One is fighting the fires when they break out. The other is trying to prevent fires, trying to think ahead, trying to design systems and strategies that make fires less likely and less damaging when they break out. And on that one, I'm afraid his track record is not so good. When he worked at the Fed under Alan Greenspan, he was absolutely in line with this Greenspan idea that you don't worry about bubbles or financial fringes when they're building up. You just clean up afterwards, and that's what we've just done the last 12 months. Mm-hmm. You really don't want to do that, and you don't want to do what we did in the last 12 months again. And more importantly, more relevantly, in terms of what he's saying now, what he's planning to do. You know, he's been giving speeches. He gave a big speech yesterday at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and he laid out his view of what the problem is and what the reform agenda is, and so on. It's all very technocratic, very hollow sounding. And it is hollow. He's not confronting or even speaking about the deeper underlying political realities here and the power of the financial sector and how it's got out of control. Now, not all of that is up to him to fix, but the intellectual leadership of the chairman of the Fed is absolutely critical for good or ill. You know, again, see what Alan Greenspan did to us over the past two decades.
So if you ran the Fed, and perhaps we're hearing what you would do if you ran the Fed, but if you ran the Fed, what would you do?
Well, I think the task that we're facing, specifically the chairman of the Fed, needs to take on the diagnosis and the definition of the problem in much more stark terms, and needs to lay out and explain to people, some of which you can do in public, some of which the chairman of the Fed can't say in public but can push for very hard in various private contexts on Capitol Hill with the administration and with the industry. You have to push for the true end of this too-big-to-fail syndrome. And having these little, you know, technocratic tweaks such as we'll have a resolution authority that will give us the legal power to deal with these banks just isn't – that's what the administration wants to do. That's what Bernanke's supporting at the moment. That's just not convincing, because when these big guys come to you – and they're across borders, for example. Citigroup is a massive global bank. And let's say if they were at some point, hypothetically, to come to you and say we're about to fail, this resolution authority that they're seeking, that they're putting all this weight on, doesn't deal with cross-border issues.
Hmm.
So even on their own narrowly defined terms, the solution they are seeking does not address the problems they faced last fall. How can this make sense? The Fed has to do things very differently.
And I'm looking at something you wrote in your website, thebaselinescenario.com, and I guess this, in part, we've been talking about this. You're saying, and I'm quoting from you, Simon Johnson, is that financial institutions have to be made smaller. They have to have more, quote, skin in the game. You have to address the revolving door between Wall Street and Washington. And again, the Fed has to, I guess, rethink its ability to be this bailout machine. Is that, in a sense, what you were calling for?
Yes, absolutely. Now, none of that is stuff that the Fed feels comfortable calling for, the existing Fed chairman or Fed structures, and that's kind of the point, right? We designed a system in which the guys in charge of the bailout, the guys who really know how the thing went wrong and what you need to do to fix it, I think they do understand this, feel constrained, they feel that's not their job to talk about it, and so on. That's a problem. That's not okay. As far as I'm concerned.
But it sounds like fixing this revolving door between Wall Street and Washington is the top priority then.
I think that's huge, to be honest. I think that there's a very clear conflict of interest when people go either from Wall Street to Washington or when they go from a key central regulatory position in Washington to Wall Street the next day, or to an advisory position to Wall Street. I think there should be a 5-year moratorium on that. I think that people will be shocked. They really don't like that proposal. They think it's outrageous. But I'm afraid we've sunk so low that you have to swing to the other extreme now. You cannot have people going back and forth and people in government thinking, aha, I'm going to land very nicely at Goldman Sachs after I'm done with this government gig. That of course, leads to perverse, crazy incentives. And by the way, when the U.S. sees this kind of thing happening in another country, when we saw it in Indonesia, for example, in fall of 1997, when the U.S. Treasury was controlled by Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Tim Geithner was also working there, the U.S. was very hard on Indonesia, very critical, and through directly and through the U.S. position of the IMF, they put a lot of pressure on the Indonesian government, which, after, you know, perhaps some unintended consequences, led to the fall of President Suharto.
Have you been asked to testify before Congress? Curious.
Yes, I've testified to quite a few committees, both the House and Senate and the Joint Economic Committee over the past 9 months or so.
And the kind of reaction that you've gotten, is it sort of like how the president got on Monday from those financial titans that were sitting in the audience there at the Federal Hall?
No. Actually, the response on Capitol Hill is pretty good at the level of we have a huge problem in our financial system and we should fix it. Mm. I think over time it's become more polarized and more partisan, which to my mind is actually be fairly productive. With the Democrats saying how we have to regulate properly and more, and there's obviously a range of opinion on the Democratic side. Mm. And on the Republican side, you have a lot of people saying, no, the problem is regulation. We should deregulate more. Right, so I'm more on the regulating camp, as you might guess, but I think that that's at the level of testimony. That's at the level of these sessions I'm involved in, which are more about the economics and the sort of economic incentives and policies going forward. The problem is when you get into the nitty gritty of designing legislation, that the special interests come into play. I have never. It's interesting. I've never been called to testify on a panel sitting next to a banker, for example. Oh. Yes,
I'd
it's interesting.
That.
I think that would be quite interesting. And at the height of the crisis, and subsequently, various people tried to arrange debates between me and, say, the American Bankers Association, or the roundtable that represents the big finance. And they don't want to talk in public. They work very effectively in private. They work behind closed doors. They have lots of leverage, I guess, and they're very good at blocking, in the trenches, what otherwise should happen.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You've had a taste of Simon Johnson's assessment of our financial system, and he's a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management, senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, co-founder of BaselineScenario.com. That's a website devoted to the global economy. And he was the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, director of its research department. And we've been picking his brain this hour of Radio Times. And again, we do want to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Vincent from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. Vincent, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, terrific guest, Professor Simon Johnson.
Thanks.
And just to support what he said, Niall Ferguson, the Harvard-Oxford professor and a good colleague, a friend of his, I'm sure, in the current edition of Newsweek, points out that the 10 largest financial institutions rose from 10% to 50%. In other words, 10 banks control 50% of the financial assets in America today. Boy, if that's not too big to fail, I don't know what is. But anyway, there was an earth-shaking earthquake judicial ruling coming out of Judge Ray Cobb's office yesterday, and it's been all over the financial media that he won't accept Bank America's settlement and the SEC settlement of $33 million, right, which is ridiculous, and he's going to have them go to trial, and it's got Congress swinging into action. And I hope Professor Johnson will be invited before the Oversight Chairman's Committee, Adolphus Towns, and I hope you get Congressman Kucinich on, because both of them have just sent Mary Shapiro a letter, the SEC chairperson that's been presiding over that agreement. Professor Johnson is right on target. Arthur Levitt is now.
Well, you know what, Vincent, hold on 1 second, because we had a lot of callers, and you put a very important issue on the table, and I want to give our guest Simon Johnson a chance to respond to that ruling by the judge. Your thoughts, Simon Johnson?
I thought that was a terrific ruling. I don't know if it'll stand up under appeal, but what the judge said was absolutely brilliant, because there's a $30 million or so settlement that the SEC had agreed to. And basically that, of course, is a fine on Bank of America and its shareholders for Bank of America misleading its shareholders, which is crazy. And the judge said, this is crazy. I want to see, I want to see the issue of the responsibility of Bank of America executives, the individuals, the people. I want to see that on the table, either in a presumably you could do that through a revised settlement or through a trial. And I think he's absolutely right. We've got to a point where the people, the individuals running our banks, are not held responsible for their actions. And that has to stop.
Let me get Dale from Kennett Square. Vincent, thanks for the call. Dale, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. A perfect segue into my comment.
Sure.
Two points briefly. One, it was a Republican, Teddy Roosevelt, that made the case that some companies were so big that they were too big to fail and they were a threat to democracy. And then having said that, the matter of personal accountability comes in. Why is it okay to have to kill people in death penalty cases, but never, it's unthinkable to put a business out of business, a death penalty for businesses. In Pennsylvania, they took the charters away from 10 or 12 banks in the 1800s because they did egregious harm.
Well, Dale, let me take your essential point and see what Simon Johnson has to say. Imagine if Lehman Brothers, or let's say AIG, was allowed to fail. What would have been the impact, do you think, Simon Johnson?
Well, I think at the moment when the government faced that problem last fall, allowing these big guys to fail can have potentially catastrophic consequences, mm-hmm. and that's the point. That's why they designed these structures, right? That's what gives them this blackmail in a crisis power. But I'd like to go back to what the caller said.
Sure.
In two dimensions. I thought he had exactly right. First of all, Teddy Roosevelt is exactly the right historical parallel here. Teddy Roosevelt stood up to the big financial industrial interests of his day. He had a massive showdown with J.P. Morgan, for example. And Teddy Roosevelt said and felt very strongly that the industrial trusts, which were finance-backed, but they were, you know, the manifest more as railroad trusts, for example, had become too powerful politically. They challenged the executive power of the United States. Andrew Jackson had the same showdown in the 1830s, by the way, with the Second Bank of the United States. And FDR had to face down the securities industry in the 1930s. This is a repeated cycle in American history. And as for the caller's point about, you know, why don't we have death penalties for businesses? The U.S. is very, very good at shutting down small and medium-sized banks. The FDIC's resolution intervention process is world-class, okay? What we cannot handle is the top 10, 13, 15 banks. That's where we choke right now. That's what has to be fixed. And the only way to fix them is to do the Teddy Roosevelt strategy, break them up.
Well, and I wonder, like an FDIC for these big banks, is that what you envision?
Well, the FDIC for these big banks has been proposed. Some people are kicking that around. That's not not really how the administration frames its proposal right now. But if you think in those terms, FDIC is an insurance arrangement. They would have to charge, for this to really work, they would have to charge an insurance premium that is appropriate for the risks being taken by these massive banks. Well, you've seen how big the risks are. You've seen all the resources, taxpayer resources, Federal Reserve resources that have to be committed when these things fail. The a properly priced insurance premium would be prohibitive, right? The large banks wouldn't be able to exist, which is fine with me. That would press them to be broken up. But realistically, they would just get a lower premium than they should otherwise. And you'd basically be carrying the existing arrangement, which is a form of implicit taxpayer guarantee that ends up being incredibly expensive and doesn't prevent them from taking on these reckless risks that we all come to regret.
We're almost about to break here, but one description I've heard of our system is that you get unfettered capitalism on the way up and socialism on the way out, or the way down, I should say, when the government intervenes.
Yeah, some people like to call it lemon socialism, meaning you only get the lemons. They only get the bad stuff.
Right.
The Wall Street expression, by the way, the very old Wall Street expression is Wall Street owns the upside and the taxpayer owns the downside. But and so in a sense, what we're seeing here is a repeat of, you know, other things Wall Street's seen before. But it's happening now on a scale that was never previously imaginable. The financial sector in this country, Marty, used to be 1-2% of GDP back, 50-100 years ago. It was 4 or 5% of our economy after World War II. Since 1980, it's moved up. It's 8%. 8%
wow.
of all we produce in this country is financial services, and these turn out to be very dangerous.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and to our callers. Simon Johnson, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, and we do have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. And after this short break, I do want to talk about executive compensation. We'll be right back.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents Jamie Wyeth, Seven Deadly Sins, now on view through November 22nd. Pride, greed, envy, and other sins are depicted using raucous scavenging seabirds as stand-ins for human frailty. The exhibit includes seven paintings of the sins and three related works completed this year. The Brandywine River Museum is located in Chadsford. Details at 610-388-2700 or at brandywinemuseum.org.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, a look at the fall TV season. Today's forecast, the chance of rain right into this evening. This afternoon's high, 69 degrees. Cloudy overnight, low falling back to 58. Tomorrow, cloudy with a few showers. Thursday's high around 65 degrees. For Friday, no rain, intervals of clouds, and perhaps some breaks of sunshine, high around 72. Plenty of sunshine Saturday, high 68 degrees.
swine flu has gone global, and here in the U.S., it has penetrated the gates of the Ivy League. Cornell University has recently reported its first H1N1-related death. More than 500 students are reported to be ill. We'll hear the latest from the campus and find out how the students are coping. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if you're just joining us, Simon Johnson is our guest. He's a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, joins us from their studios. He's the co-founder of BaselineScenario.com, and he was the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, also director of its research department, joining us today on Radio Times to give us his assessment of our financial system and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about executive compensation, something that you and many others have talked about, and certainly something that really, I think, rankles most of the public. When you look at compensation for financial executives, is it just that they get paid so much, or that somehow their pay is not connected to the performance of their company?
Well, their pay is obviously connected to the performance of their company. When things go well,
that's what
they,
I mean.
They do great. When things go badly, they don't lose. And this is a big change, by the way, from the 19th century. In the 19th century, if you managed a bank that failed, you lost your money because you were most of your wealth was in that bank. You lost your social position. You were not immediately reemployed in the government or at another major bank. Somehow we've moved away from that. The culture of executive compensation, very, very broadly defined, is make out like a bandit in the boom, and when things go wrong, you walk away with a golden parachute or a lot of cash. Or maybe you lose, the value of your shares goes down a bit, but you're still, you go from being a billionaire to being a multimillionaire. And that is definitely part of the problem here. The executives are not being careful enough because they don't have enough skin in the game.
Well, and how would you get more skin in the game, to use your phrase?
Well, I think the key thing is to make their compensation contingent on there not being a major failure. And, of course, the trick there is that these failures are not manifested within 12 months or 24 months, but they're over a much longer period of time, 5 or 10 years, for example. So there has to be a lockup and a hold on the wealth that they acquire from these activities for a long period of time. The debate is nowhere near recognizing even that principle. But if it were up to me, I think at least a 10-year hold would be appropriate.
And give shareholders more control or more say over executive pay?
Well, that certainly would be constructive. But I would also stress that shareholders need to have more equity, more commitment. The amount of capital that banks had at risk before, say, 1935, was roughly 2 or 3 times what they have now. In fact, under the National Banking Act of 1863, if your bank failed, you, the shareholder, were liable not just for the money that you already had in the company you could lose, but for another hit, which was equal to the par value of those shares. This was contingent liability or contingent capital that the bank shareholders had to put in. As a result, as you can imagine, bank shareholders were a lot more careful about who was managing their bank and what they were doing there, because they had more money at stake. If you let these banks operate with very thin cushions of capital, very thin, a little bit of equity and lots of debt, then if it fails, you, the shareholder, actually don't mind that much. If they're much more capitalized, you're going to be a lot more careful.
But what about these board compensation committees that come up with these executive salaries?
Well, it's obviously cooked. I mean, I think that's pretty obvious.
Do you think because they're all sort of part of the same club? I mean, they all literally go to the same club, send their kids to the fancy private schools.
Yes. Rakesh Khurana at Harvard Business School has written a brilliant book and some other pieces on exactly this, on how you construct this social reality and perspectives, sort of a cultural capital around boards and around compensation. And it's a huge problem. The shareholders, these companies are run primarily, the financial companies are run primarily for the insiders, primarily for the powerful insiders, and very little actually for the shareholders. It's a very, very tough problem. And we should be working on that too. While we're working on that, I think we need to break them up, make them smaller. So at least in the meantime, they're a little bit less dangerous.
Because you're saying that it's a culture where it's not unusual for someone to make millions and millions of dollars. So why wouldn't you give an executive some lovely golden parachute?
Absolutely. The whole thing is priced relative to what other executives are getting. You say, well, this guy down the road has got these incredibly generous terms. I should be getting this, or I should be getting something a bit better. And the boards are not browbeaten. The boards are convinced. They believe. And that's very important. It's a lot of this is about ideology. A lot of it is about what the shared beliefs and perspectives. It's a form of cultural capital and cultural capture by these powerful finance insiders, the like of which you've never seen before in this country or actually anywhere else.
Let me get Jerry from Haddon Heights to join our conversation. Hi, Jerry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to some of the financial regulations that were repealed and was wondering if part of the prevention of the too-big-to-fail scenario would be the reinstatement of some sort of Glass-Steagall-type protections, because when they repealed all that, that's when all this nightmare started, and these banks became way too big for their britches.
Jerry, I appreciate the call, and it's a question that I'm sure, Simon Johnson, you've thought about a lot. What do you think?
Well, Jerry is right that certainly the wave of repeal of financial restrictions around the time of the repeal of Glass-Steagall were absolutely critical here. And I would put more emphasis perhaps on some other things, that particularly the failure to regulate derivatives at the end of the Clinton administration. Just on Glass-Steagall, of course, was the measure taken in the 1930s to address the problem of the 1920s, which is that investment banks had become very much like commercial banks and were able to use some of the protections and activities of commercial banks to fund speculative investment activities. Now, I'm not sure in today's world that you know, distinction is, you know, has quite the same you know, importance. Remember, the financial sector is innovative. They move on, and they found ways for, you know, pure commercial banks to do absolutely crazy things, like lend subprime mortgages, like get involved way over their head in derivatives, while that remains commercial banking. And, of course, the investment banks did lots of crazy things as pure investment banks and made themselves so big that just as investment banks, their failure threatened the world's financial system and the world's economy. So I think, you know, I'm sympathetic to this Glass-Steagall line, but I think much, much more important, much more cutting to the modern chase is making them smaller, making them have a lot more equity and reducing the Wall Street Washington revolving door.
And what would you do about derivatives?
Well, derivatives are a very interesting and tricky matter because, mm-hmm. you know, some people in the non-financial sector say they want to be able to hedge risks, and they can do that with derivatives. But I think the consensus of opinion is moving towards putting all derivatives on exchanges and having them be much more regulated, much more transparent. And then, of course, there's the issue of to what extent you allow the financial firms to have risks, you know, what turn out to be hidden risks through their derivative positions. And I think that's where you really have to clamp down. Again, if they're smaller, you know, it doesn't matter as much if they take risks and fail. If you go to Las Vegas and lose all your money on, you know, whatever kinds of speculations, derivatives, roulette, whatever, that doesn't matter too much to me. I mean, it's your money. It's sad, but it doesn't endanger the economy.
Right.
It's when you're very big and you lose money on wild speculative gambles. And even if you're gambling on sensible financial instruments, that's where we get our huge problem.
Let me, Jerry, thanks for the call. We've got Michael now from Unionville joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, Simon. My question is about the credit rating agencies and what maybe should have done about regulating them. What basically happened was they were delivered bags of rotting offal, had their palms crossed with three pieces of silver, mm-hmm. and stamped USDA AAA prime on the stuff so it could be sold to the Fisherman's Bank of Norway or something. Seems to me those rating agencies were every bit as complicit in the subprime issue as anybody else, and is anything being done or should be done to control their activities and their methodology of risk assessment?
Michael, it's a good question. Simon Johnson, go ahead.
It's a great question, and it's a very nice statement of the problem, actually. So very little is being done to change to address the problem of credit rating agencies. Clearly, the underlying problem is they are paid by the guys who issue the securities, and they should be compensated in another way. They should be compensated by people who buy securities, and you know there's no agreement on how to do that. And I don't think this is where you're going to see change. I think the credit rating agencies are a tool. I mean, they're an instrument in the hands of these big financial players, and we should address the problem at its core at the level of, you know, how much power do the big financial players have and how to make them smaller. But I'm certainly in favor of finding ways to change the compensation or schemes that fund the credit rating agencies and allowing more entry into that business and allowing broadening the set of people who are allowed to provide ratings could also be helpful in that context.
Michael, thanks for the call. We've got Robert now from Jersey City joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. So I'm just curious to know if you are familiar with the work of Douglas Rushkoff. He just came out with a book called Life, Inc., where he talks about the corporate age being, you know, the cause of the economic crisis, basically that there's this virtual economy which is predicated on the creation of debt, not the creation of value, which was sort of the original foundations of our economy. I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on, I guess, that or his work, if you're familiar with it.
Robert, thanks for the call. You're familiar with that work, Rushkoff?
I must admit I am not, but I will try and see if I can download to my Kindle immediately after the show. I think on the point about whether we've, though the Robert's point, which is have we moved away from the creation of value to the creation of debt, that actually sounds right within the financial sector. You know, I think of it as, I think it's very important that, you know, we have a strong non-financial sector in this country. We're very good at innovating and creating things. I work at MIT. I'm not an innovator. I'm not an engineer. But I've seen a lot of that over the past 25 years. I really appreciate it. And I've seen how that becomes companies and how that becomes new products. And the non-financial side, we're the envy of the world. We have people lined up out the door at MIT from around the world wanting to understand that process of non-financial innovation. And I think where we've gone wrong is too many of us bought into the idea that financial innovation was kind of like non-financial innovation. Hmm. After all, the word innovation is really good.
Sure.
Very positive connotation in modern American culture with good reason. But financial innovation is not just like non-financial innovation. Much of modern, recent, last 20, 30 years, financial innovation has actually created, has come with these hidden risks. And these hidden risks, when they materialize, they materialize together, and they're a very big hit on the taxpayer. That's very dangerous. That's totally unlike non-financial innovation.
But I wonder how you create an economy that encourages this kind of non-financial innovation that you just described.
Oh, I think we had, Marty, an economy that was really good at that in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and 70s.
How do you bring it back, though?
I think you put finance back in its box, to be honest. Look, we had a highly regulated financial sector in that post-war period. It didn't prevent us from having big breakthroughs in technology. Think personal computers, think telecommunications. Think, actually, even within banking, the banks invented the ATMs, the teller machines where we now get our cash.
Right.
They invented, we invented venture capital in and around the financial sector. And credit cards were also invented in that relatively regulated phase. So I just don't buy the idea that you need modern, unfettered, so-called financial innovation in order to have growth. I think it's done very little for us, even in the most positive reading. And in my reading, which is not at all positive, it's led us into great and grave danger.
Well, in fact, I'm looking at the New Republic, the September 23rd edition, and it's you and Peter Boone co-authored an article. The headline reads, "The Next Financial Crisis, It's Coming, and We Just Made It Worse." Are we on the cusp of another financial crisis?
Yes, but let's be careful. Remember, back-to-back big crises are not the norm. What's the norm, and what we've seen in the last 20, 30 years in this country and other places where finance gets out of control, is you have a boom-bust bailout cycle. And the boom can last for a while. And so, you know, I think in a year's time, you might look back at this conversation and say, well, Simon was exaggerating. We haven't had a crisis. And I'm not saying we're going to have a crisis in the next 12 months. I'm saying we're building up the same kind of vulnerability that we had in 2003, 2004, 2005. And of course, it kept going until 2007. In fact, a lot of it kept going until 2008. Right? And people felt good. And people said, well, it's actually manageable. This is acceptable. This is fine. And if there's a problem, we'll clean up later. And then when you have a huge crisis and you look back at and you reassess the previous decade, or as I would say, the previous two decades of Alan Greenspan's tenure at the Fed, and you say, oh, my goodness, that we were just deceiving ourselves. That was illusory. That was ripping off people. You know, a lot of financial people walked off with much cash. But the rest of us got absolutely hammered by this experience. So we're on the cusp in that sense.
But it sounds like you're saying perhaps looking at the past, we were only able to diagnose our problem in hindsight.
Well,
and I ask that meaning because I'm curious about what, as you look ahead, you know, what and perhaps it is signs of a boom. And of course, then the bust follows the boom. But whether what you will be looking for to indicate that, here we go again.
Well, I think you look no further than the attitudes and the behavior of the financial sector. And I said at the beginning, the fact that no bank CEOs came to listen to President Obama when he, you know, was asking them very politely to please behave better in the future with or without regulatory reform, I think that tells you a lot. I think the financial sector has its swagger back. And the swagger is good for them and very bad for the rest of us. Mm-hmm. That is what we've learned the hard way over the past few years. And if you go back and look at the last 100 years and where the Fed has operated and when the Fed has been a positive force in the American economy and when it's actually not been a positive force, when it's reinforced these cycles, that's what we do in the New Republic article. I think you say, we need more financial regulation in a hurry. And if we're going to make an error here, perhaps we should err on the side of too much regulation for a while and put those guys much more like in their box as they were in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the rest of our economy, the non-financial part of our economy, I think, based on that evidence and based on what we're seeing now more broadly, would do just fine.
You've mentioned both Roosevelt's, Teddy and Franklin, saying that they stood up to the banks and the financial system. Are you saying that Obama needs to be tougher? And I mean, he used some strong language, but that he isn't tough enough with this part of our economy?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. He should have been tougher on them back in January, February, March. He felt that for whatever reason that was inappropriate. Now the economy is recovering. He should absolutely be tougher on them. He should be pushing them much harder. And I think you can see from the fact they don't even come to his speech that when you're weak, when you don't demonstrate strength, when you try to accommodate them, when you try to be nice to them, you don't get respect on Wall Street. Right? Wall Street is about power. Hmm. Wall Street is about looking at the odds, assessing the trade, and saying, yeah, we know where this one's going. Thanks very much, President Obama. We've got this one, and we're going to run the next cycle just like we ran the previous one.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Simon Johnson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's a professor at MIT Sloan School of Management, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. In fact, joined us from their studios. He's co-founder of BaselineScenario.com. That's a website devoted to the global economy. And he was the International Monetary Fund's chief economist, also director of its research department, and part of our continuing series of discussions as we talk about the economy and the financial system. Go to whyy.org/radiotime. Find out more about the program, leave us an email. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.